This session now. So we have Joshua Ginsburg now. He's a senior systems administrator at the Free Software Foundation, and his talk, which I've seen the slides for, is called Zen of the Hacker.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. This is a membership meeting of the Free Software Foundation, and you are the members of that organization, the ones who take personal responsibility for freedom and who come here to this meeting to hear the gospel, the good news that our efforts have somehow progressed the cause of freedom of information from restriction in general, but more specifically to software. And while in the past systems administrators have gotten to talk shop about the complexities of systems infrastructure improvements, web application platforms, and other such black and white zero and one developments, today I get the chance to speak with you about your liberty and to convince you that while the GNU project may very well have succeeded in creating the free operating system we needed, the work for software digital freedom faces a different challenge than it did 25 years ago. As the title of my talk suggests today, we're going to talk about the hacker. What exactly is the hacker? I consider myself one, and I'm sure many of you consider yourselves to be the same, or at least have a vague conception of what exactly one is. And if probed, our response is not unlike Justice Potter Stewart of the Supreme Court, who in 1964 said that, "I shall not today attempt to further define the kinds of material I understand to be braced within that shorthand description, and I perhaps could never succeed in intelligibly doing so, but I know it when I see it." I'll leave it as an exercise to you to figure out what exactly he was talking about. And much the same with a hacker, we could probably agree with whether a given person has this essence, this zen of the hacker. We can't quite explain it perfectly what makes one a hacker, but we know it when we see it. So I'd like to start with an example. This gentleman wanted to create a sort of commons for the intellectual and cultural enrichment of all man. Here's how it would work. Different people from a wide variety of professions and social stature would use this common resource to discover answers to questions they had on any topic of inquiry. In turn, when the opportunity arose for them to offer wisdom on subjects they were knowledgeable about, they could contribute back. He was concerned about personal differences and different social agendas polluting this quest for the simplest and purest truth. So he developed a set of rules for the community to be guided by to ensure that the end result of the discourse was a neutral point of view, as faithful to empirical truth as possible. At this point, you're probably looking around the room in search of Jimmy Wales, the creator of Wikipedia and the Wikimedia family of sites. However, the community I was referring to is far older. It was called the Leather Apron Club, founded by Benjamin Franklin. The club's members would pose questions of intellectual, moral, or social interest. They would debate, discuss, and research the questions. At the end of it, an essay was composed describing the club's conclusion to increase the greater wisdom. Rather quickly, they discovered that between them, they owned relatively few books to use in their research, and this shortage could not easily be corrected because the availability of books was too low and their cost too high. As a result, Franklin instigated a peer-to-peer sharing program where members of the club would make available to the group the collective whole of their library, so no member's intellectual and cultural enrichment was limited by scarcity of materials or financial resources. Incidentally, Franklin habitually disregarded copyright laws of his day and earned the ire of the contemporary publishing industry, sparking a wildfire of American publishers republishing British works without their author's consent. When we continue to look at Franklin, our sense of deja vu continues. Much like a modern visionary that we know very well, Franklin said of copyright and patent that, "As we enjoy great advantages from the inventions of others, we should be glad an opportunity to serve others by any invention of ours. This we should do freely and generously." Despite having invented many products that would have fetched untold fortunes in the market, Franklin, quote, "never made or proposed to make a least profit by them." Franklin was a miscreant. As a taunt to an intellectual rival, Franklin predicted his rival's death in the Poor Richard Almanac. Or as ambassador to France, he submitted fake articles to the French press simply to see how ridiculous a story he could convince them to print. By comparison, Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak used to build and sell boxes to place free long-distance phone calls prior to founding Apple Computer. Richard Feynman, researcher on the Manhattan Project, would crack safes containing classified information simply to see if he could. Franklin's inventions were hacks. He invented the bifocals because he was tired of switching between two pairs of glasses. Or that considerate contemporaries warmed themselves with indoor fireplaces, but as a side effect, they would often inadvertently burn their houses down. From observing this social ill, his solutions included the Franklin stove, a volunteer fire brigade, and the world's first fire insurance company. He hacked the world's first odometer onto his carriage to make postal delivery more efficient. There was no end to his ability to devise creative and unique solutions to practical problems for the purposes of general societal benefit. What these qualities of Franklin all have in common is unruliness, and by which I do not mean standing perpetually as a dipole against the desires of authority, but instead a disposition in which rules, limitations, and barriers are not axiomatic and not merely accepted. Instead, every lock is made to be picked, every law of nature designed to be questioned, and every problem an opportunity for a solution. Franklin, while certainly the epitome, was not unique among the framers. The framers themselves were, in a sense, government hackers, bred of the cynical philosophies of Hobbes and Locke. It has been much noted that a hack is both a term for an elegant solution and an ugly one, but they both disregard rules. The framers hacked government modules together oriented in opposition to one another, so the excesses of one would be tempered by the moderation of another. For example, much like the shortly subsequent French Revolution, the framers believed that government rules at the behest of the governed, and thus democracy should guarantee the people's assent to its leaders. Yet unlike the French, they thwarted democracy's whims and excesses with layers of republicanism in the forms of state-appointed senators, collegiately elected president, and the presidentially appointed justices. They recognized that the majority's decision should guide the ship of state, but they tempered its power with civil liberties, strictly limiting the avenues of state power. In short, the American experience as a constitutional, libertarian, democratic republic was in fact a government by hackers, for hackers. And the result, this culture of unruliness and refusal to accept the restrictions and limitations given to us has made the United States the mecca for hacker culture. Now, if this weren't true, if there weren't something so compellingly American about the zen of the hacker, it would be simple for anyone anywhere to create a community in which we would see the symptoms of hacker culture. Paul Graham, venture capitalist, identifies several such symptoms: innovative and competitive startups, educational institutions that attract and develop upcoming hacker generations, and a culture of compulsive creativity and irreverence driven by intellectual curiosity. But in practice, this doesn't happen elsewhere. What makes it work? Well, let's look at three American centers where the zen of the hacker is found. Silicon Valley in the San Francisco Bay, the Route 128 corridor around Boston and Cambridge, and Round Rock near Austin, Texas. These cities have the magical combination which makes them havens for hackers, and by extension, centers of innovation and creativity. Graham's hacker center symptoms are all present. They all have universities that function as centers of free intellectual thinking. San Francisco's geeks flow freely both from Stanford University in Palo Alto and the University of California at Berkeley. In Boston, hackers find homes wedged between MIT and Harvard. And in Austin, it draws its hackers from the halls of the University of Texas. They all have plentiful and free-flowing capital, as well as a host of larger established corporations to absorb and market successful innovators. And perhaps most importantly, they have a culture and history that draws hackers to stay. Cities are filled with young people, easy access to outdoor activities, and a rich history. They developed organically, planned bit by bit, without large-scale developments to sterilize them. And within them, creative irreverence blooms. In San Francisco, the Beta Breakers race provides an unusual showcase of creative absurdity through costumes, signage, and vehicles. In Boston, MIT maintains a healthy tradition of encouraging each class to surpass the hacks of the students from the year before. And Austin prides itself upon the weirdness of its local culture, so that when zombies march on City Hall demanding greater rights for the disenfranchised undead, a counter-protest was staged by a legion of pirates. Graham also notes that there have been many well-funded attempts to replicate Silicon Valley, but none have succeeded. Between Antibes and Nice in France lies Sophie Antipoli, a technology park the French established to rival Silicon Valley, but despite impressive investment marketing, has attracted established technology groups such as HP with its low rent and plentiful bandwidth, but But otherwise, it's just a technology park. It does not have a hacker culture. In China, the Chinese have dumped billions of yuan into Zhongguancun near Beijing, hoping Tsinghua University and Peking University might anchor its development. But entrepreneurial developments continue within the lines developed by the Chinese government, and hackers do not thrive in an environment where coloring outside the lines is a state offense. What these two examples and countless others lack is a cultural element. The personality of these cities is such that people say and do what they want, without top-down structure, but most importantly, where good ideas win. Thomas Jefferson wrote to John Adams that there is a natural aristocracy among men. The grounds of this are virtue and talent. America was built to be meritocratic, to ensure that good ideas win, not necessarily the ideas sponsored by those with the most influence and power. And this cycle of power shift and dynamic of competition is by definition disruptive and impolite. But to a hacker, the greater sin would be to ignore an elegant solution for fear of stepping on somebody else's toes. And what we're really saying about this cultural element is that the maximal expression of libertarianism in America, the sanctity of the individual against the conformity or tyranny of the masses, requires a certain tolerance of disobedience and mischief. It was the same quality in Franklin that drove him to social hack the French, as it was that inspired him to reduce property loss due to fire. It was the same quality in Feynman that compelled him to crack safes that earned him a Nobel Prize in physics. It was the same quality in MIT that drove its students to turn a building into R2-D2, as it was to incubate the GNU project. If you suffocate one, the other dies as collateral damage. When you have the liberty to be disobedient, healthy tolerance for nonconformity, and a society in which good ideas win, there you have a place where hackers will collude to do truly amazing things. And that perhaps is the most valuable element the American experiment has to export, the liberty of the individual. Fareed Zakaria, a respected political scientist, studied the relationship between wealth, libertarianism, and democracy, and found that it was the presence of libertarianism that determined the ability of wealth and democracy to thrive. Where democracy and wealth thrive, he finds a political system marked not only by free and fair elections, but also by the rule of law, separation of powers, and the protection of basic liberties of speech, assembly, religion, and property. He claims the Western model is best symbolized not by the mass plebiscite, but by the impartial judge. It is disobedience and unruliness, the hearty laughter in the face of a problem that allegedly cannot be solved. This is the zen of the hacker. His natural habitat is a culture of liberty, tolerance, and meritocracy. So having posited that liberty and tolerance for nonconformity are necessary catalysts for the preservation of the hacker species, we now consider today how America is doing. U.S. Code Title 17, Section 1201, no person shall circumvent a technological measure that effectively controls access to work protected under this title. No doubt there isn't a soul in this room unfamiliar with the anti-circumvention clause of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. A shareholder, a legislator, or a media mogul sees this provision as about this horrendously awful term they use, intellectual property. Awful, incidentally, because not only does it obfuscate three areas of law with different intents, but it's an insidious attempt to graft our natural compulsion to the right of property onto a commodity that lacks the requisite scarcity. Senator Joseph Biden, ranking Democrat on the Senate Judiciary Committee, claims that, quote, the federal government's vigilance in shielding intellectual property rights remains essential. Innovation would slow, businesses would suffer, and jobs would dissolve if technological advances were left unprotected. Now, to contrast this modern statement's viewpoint with those of the framers is remarkable. The framers recognize that hackers and hacking the current generation of technologies plants the seeds of ideas that form the next generation of technologies, that hacking and innovation are both subversive and disruptive, because when good ideas win, they come from the outside. The current generation of statesmen strangles this subversion, ironically in the name of innovation. When laws outlaw hacking, those laws guarantee that good ideas will lose. Equally dangerous to laws outlawing hacking are laws outlawing the raw materials hackers feed upon. Hackers are compulsive creators. They are compulsive problem solvers, and they are compulsive tinkerers. To deny them access to the media they use to satisfy their compulsions will guarantee that new hackers are not made, and old hackers will lose their way. The epitome of this removal of raw materials is the chemistry set. In 1918, A.C. Gilbert packaged glass tubes and common chemicals together for the first childhood chemistry set, providing curious children the opportunity to experiment, tinker, blow their eyebrows off, nurturing their natural hacker essence. Some of these sets included sodium cyanide, radioactive samples with a Geiger counter, and compounds from which one could derive free chlorine gas and nitroglycerin. Today, our chemistry sets have been sterilized. For some chemicals, an FBI criminal background check is required to purchase them. For others, because of their use in manufacturing amphetamines, they are illegal to purchase in their elemental form. Even model rocket engines are being monitored and restricted for fear of the uses of their explosive propellant. The effect of this trend is not only a chemistry set that contains little more than salt and water, but it creates official discouragement against learning to hack. The higher you raise that bar, the more hackers will decide it's not worth it to hack. As much as raw materials, hackers need other hackers. We need to surround ourselves with other hackers to both challenge our limits, but to bring us back when we've gone too far. The danger? Ted Kaczynski was a hacker who hacked alone. And by sheer probability, most hackers are not born inside the United States, but many decide rather quickly that this is where they belong. It stands to reason that America benefits from having its pick of the world's hackers. And indeed, the National Venture Capital Association reported 2 years ago that 40% of all American public technology companies were founded by foreign-born entrepreneurs. But due to more stringent visa policies, foreign hackers are studying elsewhere. In 2004, 90% of U.S. graduate schools reported a decrease in international applicants, most strikingly in engineering and the natural sciences. Furthermore, of those already with advanced degrees, few are able to complete their pilgrimages to America's hacker meccas. The United States issued only 65,000 H-1B visas for 2007, and the demand for them was so great that by the end of August 2006, they had all been claimed. To compensate for our hesitation to accept foreign hackers into our midst, we would have to ramp up our domestic cultivation of the species. But when the need is greatest, our society has steadily reduced its tolerance of nonconformity and creative mischief of hackers. In Boston, we know this all too well. In January of 2007, Peter Berdovsky and Sean Stevens were arrested in Boston on charges of placing a hoax device for attaching magnetically backed LED light displays featuring characters from the cartoon Aqua Teen Hunger Force on the BU and Longfellow bridges, prompting the city to shut down the bridges, the MBTA Red Line, and the Massachusetts General Hospital. The city was unapologetic about having erroneously identified these devices as malevolent. Police Commissioner Davis said that such a stunt was unconscionable in a post-9/11 era. 8 months later, a 19-year-old MIT engineering undergraduate named Star Simpson was arrested at gunpoint by state police after wearing into Boston Logan International Airport a homemade name tag consisting of a breadboard with LED lights and a battery that she had created for MIT Career Day. She was arrested on charges of possession of a hoax device. Again, the police were unapologetic, stating they were, quote, shocked and appalled that she wore it to an airport, again, in the post-9/11 era. A major in the state police unhesitatingly explained that had she not followed the assault team's instructions when they held her at gunpoint, she would have been killed. A month earlier in New Haven, Connecticut, a social running club called the Hash House Harriers ran afoul of police. The tradition of this club is to have their runs marked out by two members who run in advance of the pack carrying ordinary baking flour, and they left a trail of it behind them for others to follow as they ran through the local IKEA parking lot. When a customer reported two men sprinkling white powder in the parking lot, IKEA was shut down and evacuated, while police and bomb squad officials determined the nature of the white powder. When the two lead runners returned and informed police that it was baking flour, even offering to sweep it up, they were charged with a felony. A city spokeswoman explained they acted irresponsibly in doing something they knew could have instilled fear. This is the pattern. In a post-9/11 era, I hate that phrase, citizens are asked to be ever vigilant. If you see something, say something, as the maxim goes. When you have amateurs as your security front lines, it naturally follows the security reports you receive are amateurish. The government agent in receipt of an ill-informed security assessment has the choice of disregarding it or escalating it. As it stands, he is incentivized to escalate, as are his immediate superiors, and so forth. At the end of the incident, after a ridiculous quantity of money and man-hours have been spent to determine that there was no threat to begin with, the blame falls upon the nonconformist, who acted in an unexpected manner for having the temerity to confound and trick the system. Security analyst Bruce Schneier refers to this pattern as the war on the unexpected, and is part of a culture of fear, of poorly calculated risk assessments, and his well-known advice is to refuse to be terrorized. Star Simpson will probably go on to be a brilliant engineer with a magnificent career, but she is censored now. She colors inside the lines a bit more. She hacks a bit less, because she wouldn't want her hack to be confused as a bomb, again. If we culturally smother an environment in which creative nonconformity is celebrated, we will smother the joy of the hacker. Again, if you get rid of one, you get rid of the other. And again, if you provide enough official discouragement, a hacker may just decide to give up hacking. The hacker is now an endangered species. Its habitat is being threatened. The Zen is fading. John Adams wrote that a constitution of government once changed from freedom can never be restored. Liberty once lost is lost forever. Because of this, the Free Software Foundation has reinvented itself to fill its role in the array of organizations defending the beleaguered hacker and its fragile environment. DRM steals from hackers the raw materials they need for cultural and technological innovation. These digital raw materials feed and nourish the hacker instinct. So the Free Software Foundation launched the Defective by Design campaign. We injected into the public discourse this term, this concept, that a product with DRM is fundamentally defective and broken by intent. The fix is freedom. The foundation joins a coalition of partners in the quest to end software patents, for patenting the fundamental building blocks of our trade and limiting their exercise to the empowered and established ensures an environment where bad ideas and bad software products win. The FSF rallied to show the world that Microsoft Windows Vista restricted freedom even more unnecessarily than previous versions, and that free software offered a different path. And through our efforts, even average consumers have been refusing to purchase computers running Windows Vista. There will be more campaigns to come, and more fights for the Free Software Foundation to lead. And across the world, we will continue to lead the defense of the hacker in the most ethical and active of manners. And I thank you for joining us in our mission.
If it's okay, we'll take questions about that, probably in the members forum, since we're...